Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Owen Pennell. I work as a producer for BBC Arabic in the documentaries team.
Owen has an important beat. He makes TV about the Arabic-speaking world, and so he has a close eye on what is happening in the Middle East. That means monitoring local news, talking to people, and even keeping a watch of social media. And it was there, on Twitter, that Owen spotted images that would burn themselves into his brain.
Just massive, massive flames in southern Iraq that appeared to just come out of the ground.
I'm Maeve McClenaghan. This is The Tip-Off. Those images of flares from oil fields stuck with Owen, and he wasn't the only one interested in them. BBC Arabic had been talking to Greenpeace UK, and one reporter at Greenpeace's journalist unit unearthed Joe Sandler Clark. He had been thinking about the same things as Owen.
This came up a long time ago, really. I was fascinated by the issue of gas flaring, which is, if you've seen an oil field on TV or in person, that's the kind of flame that shoots out of the field. And essentially what that is gas that's produced by drilling oil, and it's set alight if there's nowhere for it to go. And in places like Iraq, where there isn't the infrastructure to process the gas, a huge amount is flared.
Joe had found some data on gas flare burn-offs that was collected by the World Bank. And when he dug into the data, he found that Iraq had the second highest number of flares in the world, second only to Russia. But what was going on with Iraqi oil these days wasn't much discussed. And that had piqued Joe's interest.
And then, as luck would have it, BBC Arabic got in touch around the same time that I started looking at that.
So while Joe got to work on his investigation, Owen at the BBC kept digging in and reading as much as he could. And he couldn't stop scrolling through all these images he'd found on social media. Flames firing all the way up into the Iraqi sky. And he wasn't alone. He was joined in his curiosity by Jess.
My name is Jess Kelly and I'm a freelance director and have been making investigative documentaries for a while now.
Owen and Jess have worked together many times in the past, and so they set out to try and get to the bottom of what was happening out near Basra in Iraq. These flares, it turned out they were from oil fields where gas is emitted during the extraction of oil. In much of the world, this gas would then be processed and used for power generation or re-injected to force out more oil from the ground. But in impoverished Iraq, the lack of infrastructure meant this gas has nowhere to go and so is set alight or vented out into the atmosphere. Flaring has been a feature of the Iraqi oil industry for decades, but it ramped up when foreign companies re-entered the country after the 2003 invasion and began increasing production. And now the scale of it, the immensity of the flares, is shocking. And it was clear that these oil fields were incredibly close to towns and villages where people were living, going about their daily lives in the glare of those flames.
And so that obviously drew us like moths to the light, and we wanted to find out what was going on with these flares.
The first step was to start talking to people in the area, calling people there, talking to local journalists on the ground. And soon they heard about a worrying trend. People in the areas around the oil fields were reporting high levels of cancer, particularly the children.
we were told that there were really high levels of cancer and other health problems in the areas around these flares, and that people in those communities were ascribing their health problems to these flares. So we wanted to find out if that was true.
Then they heard of a teenager, a boy called Ali, who lived in Rumaila, right next to an oil field which was part owned by BP.
أنا عايش في منطقة الرمال الشمالية بجانب شركة نفطية بريطانية اللي هي شركة البيبي.
That's Ali saying, I'm Ali Hussein Jalloud. I have leukemia. I live in North Rumaila next to the British oil company BP.
And even then, I think it was really clear that he had a really strong voice. He wanted to see the gas flaring stop. And he was angry as well at how other people were getting sick and how he got sick as a result of the gases that he was saying were 24/7 pumping out from these flares, and the complete lack of care that was being shown by the authorities and by the companies. So yeah, he was really compelling right from the start.
But there was a major issue with talking to Ali. Owen and Jess were making a documentary. They needed to be able to film with people, show just what was happening in these communities. But Ali lived in Rumaila. And there were strict controls about who was allowed to enter the community.
There are checkpoints all around, and you're not really allowed to enter unless you live there. So we started brainstorming how we can actually get footage from this very isolated place. And Ali actually told us that he's an aspiring filmmaker. So we gave him a camera and started working with him to get him to record video diaries of, you know, his daily life there. And the pollution.
He would take videos with the camera they'd given to him, or even on his phone, and then upload them to Dropbox, where, miles away, Owen and Jess would pore over the footage. Here's Ali giving a tour of his local area. He's saying, look at that smoke. It's really going now. I parked my motorbike here to look at this view, which we've got used to. These are the houses of Rumaila. And look at the smoke and the gases. They're all coming towards our neighbourhood. When I told the doctor I lived in this area, he said it's the main reason for your illness.
His video seeing kind of how daily life would happen alongside these horrific clouds of smoke. So a football game, for example, where you can see everyone running around, inhaling deeply, and behind them is a massive cloud of smoke. And Ali would film that, or he would show kids playing hopscotch in the shadow of a flare and talk about how this generation was breathing in this toxic air and they're not aware of the chemicals that are coursing through their veins.
But the team knew they needed more. So Owen and Jess found themselves boarding a flight and heading out to Iraq.
Yeah, to get to Basra, it's quite a difficult journey. You change usually in Istanbul, and then you fly from Istanbul to Basra. And as you approach, especially at night, all you can see is flares lighting up the skies around Basra. And it's really apocalyptic.
They started travelling from town to town, talking to everyone they could about the impact the flares were having on their lives.
I mean, everyone was telling us that cancer was like the flu in our town and that everyone was sick. And one of the things that Ali was saying was newborn babies have respiratory diseases within weeks of being born, and this very dark picture of an epidemic, really, of health issues. But there is a lack of reliable data. I mean, we looked for academic studies, we looked also for official data published by the Iraqi government. There is some official data, it's not very detailed, and we were told by doctors that those figures were inaccurate and were downplaying the levels of disease, and that essentially there was a cover-up going on.
It was a tough position to be in. The journalists were talking to families whose children were clearly very ill.
And that's when we met Fatima, who was a 13-year-old girl who lived literally meters away from big gas flares in Basra. and we followed her story. She was being treated for leukemia, which is the type of cancer closely linked to benzene. And we spent time with her family, who described sometimes the smoke being so bad that they could hardly breathe, and having kind of droplets of oil raining down from the sky and, you know, making their washing turn black.
It seemed very likely that the oil flares, burning around the clock right by her house, were in some way responsible for Fatima's and others' children's illnesses. But without the scientific tests, it was hard to show just what the flares were causing. Then the solution came to them. If the official data didn't exist or wasn't trustworthy, then they were going to have to gather their own. So the team are going to try and collect their own scientific data to fill in the hole where the official figures should be. But that is easier said than done.
We had a lot of early chats with Aidan Farrow from Greenpeace Science Unit, who was extremely helpful in talking us through what the different options were. And first of all, obviously cost is a barrier, because we can't bring, you know, really advanced equipment. Or also security is a barrier, because getting those things through customs is difficult. So Aidan, I think, was the one who suggested these kind of tubes that are like small aluminium tubes. I think he said that they'd been used in other places for this exact purpose of basically monitoring and sampling pollution from gas flares.
They also got their methodology reviewed and verified by experts at Imperial College London and Columbia University. So they knew what they were going to do. But before they could get started, they had to get their equipment into the country in the first place. They can't say too much about how that happened, but it involved getting the equipment, these metal tubes for air monitoring, through customs and security without freaking anyone out. In the country, they teamed up with a local academic, Professor Shukri Al-Hassan, who helped set up the monitors in communities around the flares. They also decided to start collecting urine samples from the children in the surrounding towns. They could send these off to be tested to see the levels of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, these compounds that are created through incomplete combustion. Testing the children's urine would show whether these compounds were accumulating in their young bodies. Those compounds have been linked to all kinds of health problems, including cancers.
Yeah, it was difficult, especially with urine sampling. We were going into communities and asking parents, can we take urine of your child? And it was, you know, quite a strange request. And it had to be done sensitively, and we needed quite large sample numbers as well.
And then there was what to do with all those urine samples.
So it was actually Owen who kept all these files of urine in his mini fridge in the hotel room in Basra.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to subject anyone else to seeing all these files of urine. Also, didn't really want any of the questions that might arise from those being discovered in my fridge.
Yeah, we had the do not disturb sign on.
Luckily, no one saw or questioned the mini fridge of urine samples, and the journalists managed to get him out of the country and off to the lab. As they left, Owen and Jess couldn't help but feel glad that no longer be surrounded by the oppressive and ever-present smog.
Yeah, I mean, we did really feel it, especially when we were filming the gas flares from up close. I remember there was one time Owen was filming through a fence and was really quite close, and he inhaled way too much and had a headache. And you really feel it, and it's genuinely a relief to arrive back in the UK or wherever we would be transiting and breathe air that is just so obviously so much cleaner. And I kept thinking, Ali has recovered from cancer, but he's still breathing this air day in, day out, and it can't be a safe place for him to live, especially with that medical history.
Back in the UK, they kept talking to Ali and others from the film as they waited for the scientific samples to be tested. They've come a long way, but they know there's part of the investigation still missing. They need to know who are the companies behind the gas flares, to get data on whether the flares have gotten worse in recent years, and if so, how they're getting away with it. All this time, Joe from Greenpeace's Unearth team has been working away. He's been researching all about Rumaila, where Ali lives.
So Rumaila has at various points been described as the backbone of the Iraqi oil industry. It produces a huge amount of oil and has massive reserves. It's got about, I think, 17 billion barrels of oil reserves. It produces 1.45 million barrels of oil a day. To put that in context, I think the UK produces 1.7 million barrels a day last time I checked. So this one field is producing like a comparable amount of oil to the whole of the UK oil industry.
Joe found that the oil field there was owned by the state-owned Basra Oil Company. And until June 2022, the field's official operator was the Rumaila Operating Organisation, ROO. That company and BP were closely connected. BP held a 47.6% participating interest in the company, and the company counted several current and former BP staffers among its senior team. Then, just last year, a company established and owned by BP and PetroChina, the Basra Energy Company, began to manage the field.
The way oil contracts work is that companies come in and they're given a role as a contractor. In BP's case, they're given a set amount of money for their work as a lead contractor, a Rumaila oil field, and that fluctuates according to the oil price. So I think the most recent figures I had that about making about $300 million profit from the field. And obviously Rumaila is producing like a lot more money than that. But the vast, vast majority of that money goes to the Iraqi state. Nevertheless, this is still like a hugely profitable field for them.
And then Joe had a breakthrough. He looked at BP's logs of their own emissions and the numbers. They just didn't seem right. And then he realised, despite their large stake in the Rumaila oil field, despite taking $300 million worth of profits from the oil produced there, BP were not counting those emission figures as their own. They were taking no responsibility or accountability for all of the emissions produced there.
So BP like claims to be making really good progress, reducing flaring, reducing emissions across the world. But we learned just by looking through their emissions numbers and talking to like industry experts that they don't count Rumaila in those numbers. So they're claiming to be making this progress on climate. As part of that, they're claiming to be making progress reducing flaring emissions. But Rumaila is just not included in any of those figures. And what we quickly realize is that no one does. There's a real kind of accountability gap in how those emissions are accounted for.
It was a startling revelation. Huge quantities of polluting gases thrown up into the atmosphere, and they're not being recorded anywhere.
And so to realise that there's this gigantic oil field in Iraq, and to realise that by our calculations, if it was included in BP's overall annual flaring emissions, that BP's annual flaring emissions would be doubled, and that no one had put those things together. I mean, it's great from a news point of view. It gives you like a nice top line. But it is also concerning that there's this huge amount of greenhouse gases being emitted and there's not much accountability or understanding of it.
Here's Owen again.
But BP weren't the only company involved. There's also Lukoil, who are a Russian company, and there's Eni, an Italian company. And one of the bits of data work that we did was just looking at how close each flare was to where people were living. So kind of mapping it out using Google Earth and seeing there's a flare, there's a flare, there's a flare. And, you know, all these flares are so close to those houses. So some of them were as close as 300 meters away. Others were like 1 or 2 kilometers away. And then what we learned from Professor Shukri is that actually Iraqi environmental law says that flares should be no closer than 10 kilometers to where people live. So it was clearly breaking Iraqi law as well.
More after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
All this time, the journalists have been trying to talk to insiders, people that work for these oil companies, to find out more about what the rules are and whether they're being broken.
We used LinkedIn and other websites to try to figure out who had worked in Iraq for BP, for example, and maybe who had left now, and people who were maybe now working on green goals, who'd kind of changed their careers and would speak to us because of a feeling of wanting to do the right thing.
Yeah, so there's a whistleblower in the film who talks about how basically BP had it in their power to reduce the levels of gas flaring, but decided it wasn't worth it because of the amount of money, you know, that would cost and the fact that it would be a hit on their profits from this contract.
They spoke to several insiders who told them similar things, but most wouldn't even consider talking on camera. It soon became clear why. This was a dangerous thing to be talking about.
There were some oil insiders who we managed to talk to inside Iraq, and they would be people that worked in the oil industry but were really angry with how things were being run. So we managed to approach them through our colleagues in Iraq, and we did quite a lot of anonymous interviews with engineers and people who said that a lot of the safety precautions were being broken, people who said that the way the flares were being run was completely outdated and highly polluting. And none of these people would speak out and complain to BP because their livelihood depended on it. And there's also the pressure of militias in Iraq, which benefit from the oil contracts. So actually, anyone who criticizes the oil industry in Iraq is taking a bit of a risk.
But just to give you an idea, you know, we had on our first deployment to Basra, someone we were working with was threatened by Iraqi intelligence and basically told, this film you're working on is going to cost us billions of dollars.
But amazingly, the team were leaked several important documents. A confidential and never-before-published report from the Iraqi Health Ministry blamed pollution from the oil industry, as well as other sources, for a 20% rise in cancer in Basra between 2015 and 2018. A second leaked document from the local government in Basra shows that cancer cases in the region were, in reality, three times higher than the official published figures. And then, months later, the results from the team's experiments started coming in. The data gathered by the air pollution monitors showed benzene levels at three times the limit set by the Iraqi government, and the urine tests on the children showed they had strikingly high PAH levels in their bodies. 70% of all the children they tested had high levels, and every single child from Ramallah did.
So the first thing you do is just forward that email to all of the different scientists that you're speaking to and basically say, what does all this mean?
And as well as understanding the data themselves, the team made sure that the individual results from the children's urine tests were relayed back to the families. They'd sought advice from experts on how to deliver this difficult news. It was important to make sure that the families understood that these were science results, not medical, and that they only showed an increase in risk of cancer, but it was by no means certain that the children would get ill. Still, it was hard news to hear.
And some of the families that we filmed with were really angry when they found out the results, because it was the first time they had proof that their kids were being subjected to pollution. And then it became a real challenge for us to try to find a way for them to channel that anger and have community meetings where they could talk about solutions and actions that they could take using the data.
But there was one person who would never hear her results. Tragically, Fatima, the 13-year-old girl the journalist had met months ago, had died from her cancer. It was a huge blow. Here's Fatima's mother.
Hello. That's what affects me. قديش أخير شيء هي وتقول على ما مو تاني يجون يقولون عشان تردين ذول المساعدين كل ما أريد بس أطيب كل شيء ما أريد.
She's showing the camera the girl's wardrobe and saying, "These are all hers. She died wearing this." Until her last day, she was saying, "I won't die. I won't die." Whenever I asked her what she wanted, she'd just say, "I just want to get better." She saw people dying at the hospital, but she remained strong to the end. The team had all the research they needed. The scientific tests, the company's own data, the satellite imagery showing how close the flares were, and the stories of teenagers and children like Fatima and Ali, who were living in this terrible landscape. But now a big question mark. They wanted to put the findings to someone in charge. Ihsan Abdul Jabbar Ismail, the Minister of Oil in Iraq. So they put in a request, hardly daring to hope that he'd agree. But then, the answer came back. He said he would do an on-camera interview.
We were really, really surprised when we heard that the oil minister had said yes. We were still in Basra at the time. He gave us a really tiny window to do it. So we had to literally get in the car and fly up to Baghdad and do the interview straight away. And yeah, there is always this feeling of, does he know kind of how much we're armed with in terms of holding him to account for this pollution in the industry he's responsible for? And I think what helped was just having that data at the tips of our fingers. So anytime he would kind of say something like, "We have too many cars in Basra and that's why the air is polluted," we could actually just respond with the figures we'd found in the communities near the oil fields. He did eventually shut down the interview, didn't want it to go any further, but we were able to use what we'd already recorded.
وجهنا كافة شركات التراخيص العاملة بالحقول النفطية الاعتماد كافة القياسات والمعايير الدولية في مسألة التقليص.
After a while, the minister called it quits and the interview was hastily terminated. Finally, after months of work, the investigation is published by the BBC. And Unearthed put out their own investigation on their website.
Yeah, I remember when we watched the news at 10 cut from home after kind of working on it during the day, it was like the first time in a long time that I saw, for example, Fatima, the girl who died of cancer during the film. It's the first time I had connected in an emotional way again, kind of seeing how audiences around the UK would watch, and she became kind of human again. And it was very, yeah, emotional to watch her story, which we'd been bogged down in, but from filmmaking, you know, wanting to make it work. And then, yeah, seeing it on the 10 o'clock news kind of really brought it home how tragic the stories of these children are whose lives are cut short.
And then things started to happen.
One of the first really important bits of impact was that the environment minister for the first time said that the health issues were as a result of the gas flaring. And that is a link that was never made by any Iraqi politicians. So that was a really big deal. And they made statements about bringing forward the year for which gas flaring should be stopped. So that was a really big impact.
And Ali was pleased to see the programme go out.
I remember he loved the poster of himself, you know, because he's the sort of poster boy of the film, and he thought he looked really cool, which he does on this poster. And I remember he was like saying that his dad was like, "Oh, now you're gonna find a wife pretty quickly, you know, with that. You look like an action hero," kind of thing. So I think that we did him proud in the end, and he did himself proud by letting the whole world see just how shocking and awful the pollution is in Rumaila and what BP are doing to that community.
In a response to the BBC's questions, BP said it reports its emissions in line with standard practice across the oil and gas industry. "We are extremely concerned by the issues raised by the BBC. We will immediately review those concerns and work with our partners on any necessary interventions. We are fully committed to supporting further improvements at this vitally important field for Iraq." Luke Oil and Eni, who are connected to other fields featured in the report, both told the BBC that they are not obligated to report flaring from non-operational fields, and that they do not contractually have control over strategy decisions or responsibility for flaring or flaring reduction in their respective oil fields. Since it first aired, the film has been used to keep the pressure on. And in April this year, Ali was due to travel to BP's annual shareholder meeting, where he was going to challenge the CEO on why his company continues to poison his neighbourhood with cancer-causing pollution. But just a few days before the meeting, tragedy struck.
We heard the news that he had passed away. I think we were both just devastated.
Ali's leukemia had returned. He was just 21 years old when he died.
Yeah, and I mean, Ali was so stoic and didn't necessarily say how bad he was feeling or how sick he was getting. We spoke to him like a few days before he died about the idea of challenging BP and the BP board at their annual meeting, and we said, "Are you going to be well enough? Are you sure you can do this?" Because he was in hospital at that time, and he was like, "Yeah, you know, I'm up for it, no problem. I'm really excited to do it." So, I mean, he was just right until the end, extremely brave and just thinking of others and just wanting to advocate for his community. And it's just an awful, awful tragedy that his life was cut short in that way. When we were first speaking to people from these communities, they were telling us cancer's like the flu. It's an epidemic here. People are dying all the time and it's because of this pollution. And you're like, wow, that sounds really bad. But until you've kind of got to know some of these kids and got to know this community, it's hard to imagine just how bad it is. And so we saw that and felt it, and it's, yeah. And hopefully, well, I think the community speaking out about it has helped to bring it out into the light.
That's all for this episode of The Tip-Off. Thanks to Owen Pinnell, Jess Kelly and Joe Sandler-Clark. There's a link to the programme Under Poisoned Skies, which is on BBC iPlayer, in the show notes, as well as a link to the unearthed online version of the story. This episode was presented and produced by me, Maeve McLennigan, with editing from Chloe Behrens, original music by Claudia Meza, sound design by Alec Cowan, and additional support from Joaquin Alvarado. Stay tuned for more stories behind the headlines.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.